In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, part two of my two-part conversation with a renowned Roswell UFO researcher who will take us backstage at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the real Area 51.
We know there were at least four subterranean levels. They had vaults back there, and Someone even said they saw an aircraft down there. But in recent years, I find this interesting, all of that has been cemented over. So you can't get down to any of those lower levels where all the action was.
This podcast is brought to you by Reverse Speech Radio, a podcast committed to telling you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Using the exact same technology as the CIA, they know because they trained them. Join hosts Christian Decadure and David John Oates every week and hear never-before-heard reversals revealing the hidden truth. Catch politicians lying. Climb inside the head of serial killers. Even hear EVPs played in reverse. Who's lying? Who's telling the truth? All will be revealed on Reverse Speech Radio. New episodes drop every Thursday. Find out more at reversespeech.ca. Listen and subscribe at reversespeechradio.libsyn.com.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
We are back with Thomas Carey, co-author along with Don Schmidt of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson Eyewitness Accounts from the Real Area 51. We mentioned earlier the Foreign Technology Division, previously known as T2 at Wright-Pat, where aircraft belonging to adversaries were taken, certainly during the Cold War. They tried to reverse engineer it. Then along comes Colonel Philip Corso, talking about his work at the Foreign Technology Division. How much of the day after Roswell, how much of his account
is credible?
That's a good question. We, for some reason, we always get questions about Corso, because I think, as far as UFO books go, that a lot of people read that book the day after Roswell. And what I didn't like about the book was that there were no footnotes or endnotes. Nothing was substantiated. It was like a fiction book, but it was nonfiction. No index. But he also tricked Senator Strom Thurmond into writing a foreword for the book. Strom Thurmond didn't know it was a UFO book, and he made all these glowing comments about Corso. As soon as he found out that it was a UFO book, he said, I'm out of this. Take me out of this. So he fooled Strom Thurmond. The other things, like he mentioned the bodies going to Fort Riley in Kansas, we don't have any knowledge of that. I mean, we pretty much know where the bodies went and when they went and how many there were. But he's got them at Fort Riley, Kansas, and at a date when they were still out in the field. Things like that. And also, he was a lieutenant colonel, if I recall. And this would be too big of a project to run for a lieutenant colonel, at least in my opinion. And I think that he was working for General Trudeau, who was the guy's name. And Trudeau says, "Oh, we got this cabinet over here full of Roswell files. See what you can." You know, I'm thinking, "Oh my goodness, what are you doing here?" The whole thing to me just did not hang together. Now, Corso had a distinguished military career. A lieutenant colonel is. I mean, there are plenty of them. The next grade, full colonel, is where you really are somebody. Anything below full colonel is sort of, it's almost, you know, sometimes the it's a gift that they give you a lieutenant colonel rating. But I just thought the rating for that project should have been in a higher grade classification. But
right, like General Twining, who ended up, as you say, chair of the Joint Chiefs.
Yes. Corso, we thank him for his service, but I don't know what he was looking at. And a lot of the stuff in there, to me, read like a fiction. And like I said, he was in charge of the back engineering projects, I guess. But like I said, the only project that I know that has been substantiated, we have the progress reports from Battelle Institute to Wright-Patterson. We have those progress reports, and you know, thanks to our associate in Florida, Anthony Bregaglia. But Corso, you're just relying on him, and. The thing in his favor, though, is he seemed to have had a good life. He didn't need this to make, you know, make a name for himself. He had a fine military career, and making statements like he did is going out on a limb. So in that respect, I have to consider it, because he was out on a limb when he didn't have to be.
Can you even place him based on your research? Can you place him at Wright-Patterson?
No, we can't.
What's interesting is about that book is The Day After Roswell. That book, from my understanding, is what led our former defense minister, deputy prime minister, the Honorable Paul Hellyer, to first seriously delve into the whole UFO ET issue. It was that very book.
That was a New York Times bestseller. The goal of every author is to get on the New York Times bestseller list, and that book made it. And I'm trying to think of another UFO book that did, and I can't. So a lot of people read that book, and I didn't know Paul Hellyer, that was his inspiration, but well, there you go.
Mm-hmm. I just want to take a minute. We didn't do this in hour one, but we talked a little bit about, you know, the 18 building complex, A through G, and Hangar 23. But just kind of give us a sense of the size and the scope of Wright-Patterson above ground and below.
Well, I was never there. Don has been there. I have never been there, but going by some of the witnesses that we talked to, they felt that most of 90% of Wright-Patterson is underground. Because you drive around, you see an empty field, but you see these air vents coming up out of the ground. So it's in our book of people who've gone to Wright-Patterson that they're struck by the fact that there's a lot of open space, but they have these signs that and the percentage that we heard was like 90% of Wright-Patterson is underground. And we do have statements in the book from fellows who they're dead now, but actually helped build the various subterranean levels, and they saw things down there. And so, you know, it was a strategic air command base, a SAC base, but they want to have things bomb proofed so they can function if we're ever attacked. And so a lot of it is in subterranean vaults and caverns and things like that. And what's interesting is this Hangar 23/18. We know there were at least four subterranean levels to that. They had vaults back there, and someone even said they saw an aircraft down there. But in recent years, I find this interesting, all of that has been cemented over.
Ah.
All of that has been cemented over, so you can't get down to any of those lower levels where all the action was. And I just find that interesting.
But part of Wright-Pat is open to the public, right? To tourists and students,
yes,
and things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They have our last chapter is called it's something about, let me look at it. It's In the Shadow of Ghosts. Yes, In the Shadow of Ghosts is our last chapter. It's about visitors to Wright-Patterson today. The base is full of ghosts from things like what we're talking about. And a lot of people ask about Hangar 8. Hangar 18 is the number one question they have. And, of course, there never was one, but some of them will admit that there were things stored there, but they don't know any more than that. So
I want to take some time and talk about the late Senator Barry Goldwater and his, well, it seemed like for decades, he tried desperately to take a peek inside Wright-Pat. I mean, and here is a distinguished senator from Arizona who sat on the Armed Services Committee, the Aeronautical and Space Sciences Committee. He was the chair of the Strategic Nuclear Forces Committee. And yet he asks to go see Wright-Patterson and he's shut down. Now, who is this General Curtis LeMay, and how and why does he have the power to tell Senator Goldwater, you're not allowed?
Well, he was the Air Force Chief of Staff. That was his power. Curtis Bombs Away LeMay was a hero from World War II. And by 1961, he rose to become the Air Force Chief of Staff with 4 stars. And that's a full general. That's not like that's not a 5-star. It's a full 4-star general. So he's Air Force Chief of Staff. Barry Goldwater is a respected senator from New Mexico, Arizona, in the U.S. Senate, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So he's a powerful man. And he was respected on both sides of the aisle, unlike today's politics. He was also a UFO buff. He was also a major general, that's two stars, in the Air Force Reserve. So he's wearing several hats. He's a U.S. senator. He's a general in the Air Force Reserve. Man of great talent. And he ran for president in 1964. He lost to Lyndon Johnson in a landslide, which was the post-Kennedy assassination first election after that. So a lot of sympathy going there. So he's out in Wright-Patterson. And then we figure this is 1963 now. 1963. Because LeMay was chairman of the chief of staff from 1961 to 1965 when he retired. So this is 1963. And so Goldwater's at Wright-Patterson. And he's heard about Roswell from his good friend, William Blanchard, General Blanchard. He was a colonel back in 47 at the base, on the base.
The 509, yeah.
509th Bomb Group and base commander. He was a full colonel. And he rises to four stars himself by age 50. Blanchard has four stars. He's going to be the next chief of staff, in the Air Force. He dies at age 50 as the vice chief of staff in 1966. So, but Goldwater learned about Roswell and this so-called blue room at Wright-Patterson where all the alien artifacts were stored. That was the rumor. So he's at Wright-Patterson. He said, I wonder if I, I'm interested in flying saucer. I heard about this. I'm going to call up LeMay just to make sure. He says, General, I'm here at Wright-Patterson. I've heard about this room where you have all of this alien stuff. Might I go in there? And he said it was the first time you ever heard LeMay lose it because they were good friends. He said he dressed me up one side and down the other. No, you can't go in there. Hell no, you can't go in there. I can't go in there. And don't you ever ask me that again, or I'll see that you're court-martialed. Well, thank goodness they were friends, huh?
Oh, my God. So, yeah, some friend.
Yes. So Goldwater said he tried a few more times there, but then he finally gave up. He couldn't get anywhere. And whether it was LeMay himself could not get in there. Maybe it was just to put an exclamation point on what he was saying, but maybe also he was banned as well by whoever was controlling that, and we don't know who that is himself, so we don't know. But we heard it from another witness who was there at the time. He says, boy, that was the buzz on the base for a couple of days that Goldwater was turned down by LeMay from going into this blue room.
Now, getting back to Colonel William Blanchard, the commanding officer at the 509 in Roswell during the UFO incident, and he tells Goldwater, that everything that you've heard about Roswell is true?
Well, yes. I mean, he's not going to lie to Goldwater. I mean, they're good friends. They're both Air Force generals. And he knew that Goldwater was a UFO buff, but interested in UFOs. And whether he was on a flight somewhere, we don't know. But that's where Goldwater learned about the Blue Room and about the artifacts and Roswell, that Roswell was real. It was from his good friend. And he says that Blanchard was his good friend. So that's who he learned it from.
And as you say, Blanchard was kind of fast-tracked to go to the top, but died of, I think it was a massive heart attack at his desk at the age of 50. Are we sure that was a heart attack, Thomas?
Yeah, well, That's what we're told. It was at his desk. What's interesting, see, is Blanchard is was a West Point graduate. He was a football and ice hockey star for your Toronto visitors, listeners. Blanchard was an ice hockey star as well as a football star. He was 6'4" or 6'5", which was tall in those days. He had movie star good looks. Every other officer in the Air Force knew that he was going to be chief of staff someday. You know how it is, that you have that sun spotlight on you. And he couldn't wait to get rid of that. When the Roswell crash happened, he could not wait to have someone else take that over. Ramey took it over, Roger Ramey.
Right.
And even Ramey knew that Blanchard would surpass him one day in rank. And so Blanchard was happy that someone else took over this, because he didn't want anything on his record that would, besmirch his record to the top. And that's what his eye, he had the eye on the prize, which was chief of staff.
What would that have meant, though, for disclosure? Just think of, we have the commanding officer at the 509 during Roswell, who is admitted to, you know, the former chair of some very powerful Senate committees, that Roswell is true. There were aliens, there was UFOs, they crashed, they were taken to Wright-Patterson. And now all of a sudden, you know, we have Blanchard as ultimately becoming, maybe a full four-star general on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I mean, what would that have meant to have a guy like that in that position? What would that have meant for disclosure?
He did not want to be his name in the same paragraph as UFOs or Roswell. He wanted to get as far away from that Roswell thing as he could, because Roswell, UFOs is still a taboo subject to people in the limelight, whether you're talking especially politicians. They don't want to – don't put my name in that story.
Except he'd already told Goldwater, and then Goldwater writes about it in a book. So the cat's out of the bag.
Well, Blanchard was already dead.
True. Yeah.
So Blanchard was written about in 1980 in the Roswell incident. So he's dead and buried. So it's, that can't hurt him anymore.
No. But I'm just wondering, had he lived though?
Had he lived?
Yeah.
UFOs is viewed as an impediment. If you're looking to rise,
right?
Especially in the military, where this is still, the Air Force position is that it was a Project Mogul balloon, and that the little bodies were these dime store mannequins from the. That's mannequins,
right?
That's their official position. You don't want to go challenging that if you want to go up to the top. You want to show that you're a team player. So wouldn't have meant anything.
He would have denied it, or he would have maybe, had he lived, he would have told Barry, hey, do me a favor. Don't just leave my name out of that book.
I'll give you another example. Senator Joseph Montoya from New Mexico.
Yes.
Back in 47 was the lieutenant governor of New Mexico. He was there dedicating an aircraft, and the wreckage in the bodies started coming in when he was there, and you have to figure that the base commander went on leave. We know he didn't go on leave. He went out to the crash site. The governor of New Mexico split. He was supposed to be going down to Roswell dedicate the Air Force Day or something like that. He split to the mountains. It was like all people in positions of authority that might be called upon for an explanation. They all got out of Dodge.
Right.
So that left Joseph Montoya by himself, and he had a few Montoyistas, or young people who were supporters of his. They were called Montoyistas. And so he went over to the hangar area to visit with them. And while he was there, in comes the first parts of the wreckage and the little bodies, and he lost it. He said, "Oh my goodness, what is this?" And he saw the little bodies with the big heads. And he says, "Where's the phone? Where's the phone? Get me the nearest phone." So he called a local Montoyista in Roswell. "Get over here. Get me the hell out of here as quick as I can. I'll be over by the water tower." Well, the water tower is still there. The hangar is still there. And they went and got Montoya and drove him to their house. And this the fellow's name was Peter Anaya, local Montoyista. And so they kept Montoya at the house to calm him down. He says, "Well, you could get me a drink. Do you have a drink?" He says, "Well, we got some Jim Beam." He said, "Give me the bottle." He takes the bottle of Jim Beam and glug, 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 glug. He drains the bottle and he collapses, goes to sleep on the couch. But according to Peter and his brother, Ruben Anaya, it was a fitful sleep. He was jerking and he was just in horrible shape. This is even after a bottle of Jim Beam. And so finally he wakes up and he says, "Okay, take me back to the hotel." So they took him back to the Nixon Hotel in Roswell. Well, years later, in 2002, we're making a documentary for the Sci-Fi Channel called The Roswell Crash, Startling New Evidence. It was a two-hour special for the Sci-Fi Channel put together by Don Schmidt and myself. Bryant Gumbel was the host.
Right.
And they interviewed Ruben and Pete Anaya on that show. Well, I was there down in Roswell when they were interviewing them. And I noticed that Pete Anaya's son, who was in his early 30s, was there as well. So I went over to Pete Anaya's son. I said, "Hey, and his son said, he says, "Yes, I worked for Senator Montoya." He was a staffer of Senator Montoya. I said, "Well, did he ever tell you that story about that day down in Roswell?" He said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes." I said, "Well, what did he say?" He says, "It was all true. But if anybody ever asked me about it, I will deny it entirely. But it was all true."
Right.
So that gives you they'll talk on the QT, but officially they don't want anything to do with UFOs, Roswell, paranormal, that sort of stuff.
More of my conversation with Thomas Carey when Conspiracy Unlimited returns. My Strange Planet shop is filled to the rafters and bursting with great gear. Check out the Toxic Mail and the Protect Our Power Grid t-shirts. My personal favorite right now, though, is my line of t-shirts celebrating carbon dioxide, the miracle molecule that makes life possible on our planet. But there's more than just t-shirts. There's mugs, phone cases, great hoodies and sweatshirts, tote bags, stickers, and more. The proceeds from the Strange Planet shop goes to support the work I do here. They help make this podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, and my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, all possible. So get on up to my Strange Planet shop today. Just go to strangeplanet.ca. Remember, Christmas is coming. It's a strange planet. Get the gear.
Theoretical physicists say that there is as many as 12 hyperdimensions. Here are just three of them. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Pretty cool, huh? Here's an extra one. Conspiracy Unlimited. Hey, how about one more? Conspiracy Unlimited. And the great thing is we have 6 hyperdimensions left. Conspiracy Unlimited. 5.
Thomas Carey, co-author of UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, is here. You received an email from a woman in Georgia who was a freshman at the University of Georgia back in the early 60s, and she had a roommate from Alabama who had an interesting story to tell about it. Yeah.
That is my longest held lead. That lead lasted me 17 years. That's why when people go, they said, well, I'm going to go down to Roswell this weekend and solve that case. Oh, yeah. Sure you are.
but this involved, yeah, this involves yeah. Operation Paperclip, because I want to get into that. But
yes. Well, this lead, 17 years. I got this email. This woman in Georgia went to the University of Georgia, and she saw our Sci-Fi Channel special. She wrote to me and said that in 1964, she was a freshman at the University of Georgia, and her roommate, her father, was a German who had come over with Operation Paperclip, and they flew him from Fort Bliss in Texas to Fort Worth to do some research on the wreckage. But while he was there, they told him, don't look at these little bodies. Of course he looked at the little bodies that were there. And I said, oh, my goodness. So for 17 years, and I won't go through all the twists and turns, it took us, let's say, 15 years to find. It turned out to be not the girl's father, but her boyfriend's father.
Hmm.
And we were looking for the wrong name. And it was through a fortuitous publication of an article in a local newspaper down there in Huntsville. The girl was from Huntsville, Alabama, where our space program is. And her brother wrote an article in a newspaper saying, called Growing Up in a Rocket Family or something like that. And he had the same last name as this girl at the University of Georgia. And so I sent the article to my source. And she says, oh, my goodness, we're looking for the wrong guy. We want her boyfriend's father, which had a different name. And we found the daughter that was her former roommate. And so we made plans that she would contact her and try to corroborate the story. Well, she did contact her, even in person, but she never asked her the story. So I said, oh, my God, what am I, this is 17 years now. Yeah, how much longer do you want me to wait, So I called the girl, the woman myself. She was divorced twice, had two different last names, but we found her. I called her up. This is last year. And first she did, she remembered, oh, yeah, she was my roommate. Yes, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I don't remember that story. No, I don't remember that. And I said, oh, because this woman sounded like she was telling the truth. And by the end of her, then she got off the phone, and I heard her talking to somebody in the back. And finally, she came back on. She said, well, I can't remember everything I ever said, which to me was a confirmation.
She was walking it back. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's 17 years.
Oh, my.
For that one witness. It's a record. And I just have to laugh when you say, oh, we're going down to Roswell this week. We're going to try to solve that case.
Right. I mean, it is a swamp, isn't it? The whole Roswell investigation. But it does lead us into a little more depth into Operation Paperclip. During which time the United States exfiltrated, I guess, somewhere between 500 and 600 German scientists.
Totally, yeah.
And their families, including, of course, the head of the V-2 rocket program, the rocket man himself, Werner von Braun. We're coming up onto a break here. I just want to start, sort of dip our toe into this conversation about Werner, and then we'll come back. But what do we know about von Braun's coming and going at Wright-Patt? Did he spend a lot of time there?
Well, we never thought he did, but we have witnesses who said he was there a lot, and which made sense, being the father of our space program, and he would the witness that I'm thinking of said that. He was always accompanied by security people because he was, you know, a paperclip German, and very important, but he was always accompanied by security. And they would go into this hangar, stay there and come out. Go into this hangar, stay there. He was always going to the same place at Wright-Patterson. And this particular witness said that he was a guard at this hangar, and that one day this truck pulled up, backed in, and the hangar door closed, and the truck was in there for a while, and then the hangar door opened, and out drove the truck, but there was something underneath the tarp in the back that was, they said it was circular. I think it was the inner cabin that we talked about before, because it was the size and shape of a Volkswagen Beetle under a tarp, just like it was described going down Main Street in 1947. So that was the hangar where they kept the escape capsule or inner cabin. Whether they ever got into it or not, I don't know.
Back with more in a moment. Thomas, this is a short segment, but we can finish up on the Wernher von Braun story. So was he seen then coming and going from the infamous Blue Room?
Well, you can speculate that it was the Blue Room or Hangar 18, but whether it was one or the other, out came this this artifact from the Roswell crash, this inner cabin escape capsule. We don't know what else was in there, but you can speculate that that's what it was.
He sort of talked in kind of vague terms about the ET presence here on Earth. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yes, you would figure that being a physicist, space program, rocket development, that he and some of the high-ranking paperclip Germans who were brought over starting in late 1945, and originally they were housed at Fort Bliss in Texas, would be called to the crash site, and they were. I think the astronaut James Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell.
Edgar Mitchell. I have so many names going. You know what I mean?
I know.
Names, dates, places. Edgar Mitchell mentioned that, and there were others who mentioned that. We had a witness who put him there, plus some of the other high-ranking ones. The Germans felt that they were brought to the site to confirm that it wasn't Russian, that what had crashed was not Russian. Well, they knew right away that it wasn't Russian, and they felt that that was what they wanted from the Germans, was to tell them that whether it was Russian or not. And they, of course, said, no, this is not Russian. So he was at the crash site, and he was very tight-lipped, but at some point he did reveal that in an article in some journal and during a speech somewhere, and I think the words were, we are confronted by a power much greater than our own, something to that effect. And I know I'm butchering the statement, but there was some statement that we are confronted with a power much greater than our own, but we don't know what their home base is.
Right.
Yeah, something like that. And so he knew. Certainly he knew all the higher-ups, and he was the top man in the space program, worked for NASA, worked for the Army. We got our first satellite, Explorer 1, up because of him. And he had a second in command was a fellow by the name of Ernst Steinhoff, a nuclear physicist engineer who had a similar career. But he stayed at mostly at Alamogordo with the guided missile program rather than the space program. Although he was, he got interested in the space, and he's in the New Mexico Hall of Fame, and another one as well.
Right.
But it, these fellows were, what's his name? Von Braun died at age 65, which today is young.
Yes.
And Steinhoff died at age 89, just a few years ago. But they were there at the crash site. There were paperclip Germans stationed permanently at Wright-Patterson, and also at Alamogordo Holloman Air Force Base. So they had a lot to do with our space program. And after World War II, the race was on to get as many of those paperclip Germans as they could, because the Russians were after them as well. But the prize, the big catch, was Werner von Braun.
Now, some of these Nazi scientists that came over and were working inside Wright-Patt, I think in the book you mentioned, and I'm not sure if it was the one who you mentioned in association with von Braun, they went later to work with in the private sector, like with the RAND Corporation and so forth, didn't they?
Oh, yes. RAND, I believe, stands for Research and Development. Yes, they, you know, some went to Lockheed, some went to think tanks like RAND. You know, they were the best in the field. They were the best in the field. So,
you write in the book that all of the UFO debris and the alien bodies were likely cleared out of Wright-Patt by the mid-1980s. Why was that, and where do you suppose they ended up?
We learned from a fellow who worked at FTD. He worked at FTD. And we got that information because we ourselves did not know. We knew they got the right field, Wright-Patterson. And we knew that there were sightings of individual bodies being autopsied at various places around the country in subsequent years, suggesting that they were lending them out for study. But this fellow that worked at FTD, he said pretty knowledgeably, at least he appeared, that the bodies left Wright-Patterson in the early 80s, about 1982, 83, for Area 51. So we take his word that, at least, you know, that's what he said, that they went to Area 51. And the reason was because Wright-Patterson, Dayton, Ohio, was getting too built up around Wright-Patterson. And they were fearful of testing aircraft in that congested or that metropolitan area and have one crash in people's neighborhoods. So they needed a place more open. And especially with the testing of these, at the time, high altitude spy planes, and then later on the stealth aircraft, the area around Wright Field, in Dayton, was too built up at this time. Plus, there were too many rumors going on about what was there of an extraterrestrial nature. To use an acronym, the place got too hot. The place got too hot, and they had to do something. So they got rid of at least the bodies. Probably some of the wreckage went elsewhere. But right now, where at least the Roswell bodies are, we had a former head of FTD named George Weinbrenner, General George Weinbrenner, on his deathbed, told somebody that we have five of them in Utah. That would be at Dugway. We believe that the five Roswell cadavers are at Dugway. It's like an Area 51, but in Utah. If there are other bodies, I don't know about where, you know, there are plenty of places they could be, you know, but my own focus was Roswell, where they might be. And we believe that they're currently in Utah.
Subsequent to Roswell, do you know, do you have knowledge that other UFO crash debris materials were taken to Wright-Patt post 47?
Yes. I myself have always been skeptical of additional crashes, but we have a chapter in the book that discusses exactly that, Richard. I'd have to look at the book to tell you which chapter that is, but we have a chapter. It's based on the work of Leonard Stringfield, who in 1978 broke the crash barrier. Up until that point, talking about bodies or extraterrestrial beings and crashes was taboo even amongst UFO buffs. But he broke the crash barrier in 1978 because he had so many friends. He lived in Cincinnati. He had so many friends at Dayton, that lived in Dayton, had worked at Wright, and had heard all the rumors, that he started putting together these monographs called the there were eight of them, and it was all they were all eight were about UFO crashes. And he died in 1994 after his last one. And so we have a whole chapter based on Leonard Stringfield's work, what people told him. Now, the thing about Leonard was that he didn't name his sources, which is unfortunate, because we certainly would follow up to corroborate or, you know, debunk whatever the case may be, but to interview the witnesses. But he did not name in his monographs, that he did not give the names. And it turns out that one of them was Jesse Marcel. That was one of the early ones, was Jesse Marcel. And another fella who we nicknamed Tim was a fellow by the name of Lloyd Thompson, who we knew about, was also at 509th Bomb Group. But we did learn the name of one of the doctors who was there at the autopsy one of the aliens from Roswell. So we did learn a few of them, but it's all in that chapter. I think it's called Leonard Stringfield and the Little Green Men, I think is the title of the chapter. So as far as the additional crashes, he has the stories that he has in there suggest strongly of a number of additional UFO crashes. Now, I myself have not investigated any of those because Roswell proved to be a labor-intensive undertaking. We've spent the last quarter century solely on Roswell because there were so many witnesses, we have hundreds, that know their little piece of the story. None of them go beyond their little piece of the story. And it was our job, like a puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle, to put them all together into a coherent narrative, which I believe that we have done. And the second part of that narrative is what happened at Wright-Patterson after the material and the bodies were taken there.
Well, Thomas, I know that Stanton is looking down and and thinking about you and Don, and saying to himself, a job well done. UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson. How can people get a hold of the book?
The Barnes & Noble, of course, is our book distributors, Barnes & Noble. And most people go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble online. You can get it there. I'd have to check to see if you can get it through our website. But most people, I know myself, when I order a book, non-UFO book, I go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And you can take a look at our website, www.roswellinvestigator.com. And that's pretty much where these days you can buy your books. I suspect you buy your books at Amazon, too.
When possible, I like to buy them directly from the author. So, people should go to roswellinvestigator.com first to see if they can get the book there. That would be good. Thomas, what a pleasure. Thank you so much, and thank you for UFO Secrets Inside Wright-Patterson.
Thank you, Richard. It was a distinct pleasure talking to you.
Okay, before I dim the lights in my little studio beneath the stairs, I'll be back with a few words on an upcoming episode. If you're a fan of this podcast or my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, or my YouTube channel, Strange Planet, I hope you'll consider becoming an official donor. A donation of $50 a month places you in the Star Chamber. $20 a month is the whistleblower tier, and a donation of just $10 per month makes you a truth seeker. Star Chamber and Whistleblower members can participate in an exclusive monthly online chat or video conference with me. And all donors are entered into a monthly draw for Strange Planet merchandise. Any monthly amount is welcome and greatly appreciated. To become an official donor, go to patreon.com/strangeplanet. patreon.com/strangeplanet. Coming up next time on Conspiracy Unlimited, Lee Harvey Oswald's doppelganger. Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.